they got on a three roll and we couldn't make a three, or, you know, we couldn't really make a play. We couldn't get rebounds even in a timely manner. So just a lot of things. They're a good team. They played well, but we had our chances. We just didn't finish it off. We came out flat second half for whatever reason. Maybe being up 22 did it. I don't know.
Rockets are up 22 at half. They lost to Oklahoma City on Saturday in the showcase game on ABC on Saturday night. My biggest takeaway from the game is, in direct contrast to the last 2 years, I think Oklahoma City is better than Houston is. And I say that even if Clint Capela was back and healthy. And the reason why is, when you look at Oklahoma City, I actually think Westbrook is not quite as efficient as he used to be, especially, you know, based on 2 years ago. But they have better role players, and Paul George is playing at a spectacular level this year. He has been outstanding.
But so is Harden, and Clint Capela's not playing. I don't know how you can say that they're better when Capella's on the court, Thunder than the Rockets.
If you look at the NBA standings, the point differential, Oklahoma City's is way better than Houston. And it's not like Capella's been gone the whole season. He has played most of the Rockets.
He's been gone a while. Chris Paul has been gone before that.
I get it.
I guess the question would be, look, Paul George is playing really, really,
awesome.
really well. But also, I think Russ Westbrook, at least from when I've watched him, it looks like he's deferring to Paul George. There's, maybe it just took old age for Russell Westbrook to start realizing, like, all right, this is like, I'll genuinely try to find, some kind of relationship with him on the court, with somebody else on the court, instead of just, you know, instead of just having it be herky jerky. I can't separate the two. Like, I can't sit and say, all right, well, with Clint Capela back, then all of a sudden Oklahoma City's size advantage and physicality advantage, which was great without Clint Capela, isn't going to be greatly fixed or greatly improved with Clint Capela back. Like, that, I think it makes a huge difference. And then I think the other big thing, okay, one of the problems with the Rockets now, obviously, is the bench. Clint Capela coming back helps the bench out, too.
True.
So I think I'm more inclined to say that these two teams would have a battle in the playoffs as long as Clint Capela was on the floor. I can't sit there and say that Oklahoma City is definitively better when, like, look at Oklahoma City and how much they got trashed in the first half. Like, the Rockets were capable of going up by as much as they did in the first half because Oklahoma City is an evenly matched team, but the Rockets were on their run. But the Rockets, without Clint Capela, don't have the ability to slow down the comeback.
The Rockets are much deeper than them. I mean, Dennis Schroeder is essentially the only guy of any consequence coming off the bench for Oklahoma City. That's it. The rest of the bench, I mean, G.D. Patterson is in the league somehow still. Like, they have him on the bench. Cool, neat, awesome. Pat, woohoo! Like, that's it. The Rockets bench is better. The Rockets are a better team. The problem is,
they're a better team.
Yeah, they're a better team. When they're healthy, they're a better team. The problem is that they are not healthy right now, and that's probably going to hurt them from a seeding perspective as they wait for Clint Capela to get back. It's, what, 2 weeks away or something? It's supposed to be after the All-Star break where he could theoretically be back on the court. And then when he's back, they're going to have to figure out how to get all this together. Because the biggest problem for them over the last couple of seasons is that whenever they finally get the regular cast of characters playing with one another, it's essentially happening in February or in March as opposed to during the offseason. And because Daryl Morey had such a poor offseason with the moves that he made, that's why they're in this position right now. Here's what sucks the most about Saturday's loss. There were moments in this game where I thought to myself, that looks like Chris Paul. That looks like the same Chris Paul that could be the secondary piece for a James Harden-led team going up against the Golden State Warriors. And I remember in the first half, I thought to myself, man, when Capella's back, I'm not going to talk myself into the idea of the Rockets beating the Warriors in a seven-game series, but I can talk myself into the series being competitive. And then they just completely crap themselves in the third quarter, which, again, you don't have Clint Capela out there. You got to figure out what you're doing with Kenneth Faried, Mike D'Antoni. You got to be better from that perspective. But at the end of the game, still, I saw Chris Paul doing Chris Paul things. Like, that was what I wanted my takeaway to be from Saturday night. Instead, it's they blew a 26-point lead.
That I agree with about Chris Paul. So we're going through our biggest takeaways
from
the Rockets' collapse against the Thunder on Saturday. Mike, Seth, and Paul. To your point, Paul, Mike D'Antoni, I think, agrees with you. He said on Sunday, yesterday, I was more encouraged than discouraged by the loss. I saw a team that could compete for a title last night for a big part of the game. So that was D'Antoni's take on Sunday.
Right. And, like, for me, I for the life of me, I feel like people are both in love with Clint Capela, yet at the same time don't believe in Clint Capela. And maybe there's just two different groups of people. But there's a reason the Rockets gave Clint Capela $90 million. And when a $90 million player, and we're not talking 5 years ago when, you know, everybody was getting a huge contract, when Ryan Andersons were getting huge contracts. Like, there's a reason that Clint Capela made that money. And it's not just based on upside, obviously. What he brings offensively, what he brings defensively, what he brings from a rebounding perspective, all those things, is that he's your third best player on a team right now. And we know in the NBA, when you lose your third best player, that's a big, big, big deal. In particular, like, I agree with you, Paul. I think the Rockets have a better bench than Oklahoma City. I think the biggest thing is that without Clint Capela, there's a huge physicality difference, and it's just obvious and glaring. It's not like Clint Capela is out there like a 90s Pistons player or something, but it's obvious just from the eyeball test what they're missing when he's not there.
Okay, so
I would like it if Clint Capela came out there and all of a sudden started just
elbowing people in the face.
Shop. Yeah,
Bill
yeah.
Lambeering guys.
Yeah,
I hope you guys are right about the Rockets versus OKC, because I felt the last 2 years, 2 years ago, when Westbrook won MVP over Harden and he shouldn't have. The Rockets were clearly the better team. They beat them in five games.
Oh, they were clearly better. Here's the problem, and to your point, Mike, they're not that, like, even if they're fully healthy, I don't think they're that far ahead of Oklahoma City. I think they're a better team, but the problem is they're closer back to the pack than they were last season, okay, where it was clearly them and Golden State.
Yes. I think that we can definitely agree with. That whether we think the Rockets are better or not, I think they're worse than OKC. You guys think they're better, but they're basically hovering around the same kind of general plane as OKC, which is far behind.
I honestly, man, I think maybe this won't bear out, but I really think you've been affected too much by the injuries. I think your image of what the Rockets are is looking through the lens of the team you've seen over the past couple months, where Chris Paul hasn't been there, Eric Gordon hasn't been there, and then Clint Capela hasn't been there. Like, it's just what we've seen pretty much this entire season isn't the team you're going to see in the playoffs. So right now, yeah, I agree with you. But it's knock on wood, with everybody healthy and with all four of those guys that we've just been talking about, including James Harden, on the court, I think it's the second best team in the NBA.
And this is a more shallow West. The East took a big step forward this year, and especially the trade deadline with the moves that Philly and Toronto made before the deadline. Like, those two teams took a real step forward. I mean, the West is essentially Golden State, Oklahoma City, and the Rockets. But do we really buy into Portland? No. You never should buy into Portland. You shouldn't buy into Denver either. Like, this league's about stars. Those three teams, they have the kind of star power that can actually carry them far. It's those three teams in the West. So, it's hard to, like, you look at the Rockets right now, and a Saturday night game against the Oklahoma City Thunder is not the end-all, be-all, but it's frustrating in that they showed some signs, I think, of being the team that they were last year. Some signs. And at the end of the day, they blew a 26-point lead.
The hardest thing about the Rockets has been and will be for a long time that they're going to be streaky. Like, that's just, it's the nature of the beast. If they were as good on defense this year as they were last year, then they're less streaky. But there are going to be streaks. It's just where they've had so many 20-plus point leads over the last four games. You've seen, like, an extreme version of it. And you can never erase the consecutive missed three-pointers from last year. It's like, it's tattooed on our brains right now.
I've let it go.
And it's gone to, no, you haven't. You haven't. That's
you let
why
it go?
That's why you're sitting here saying that Oklahoma City is better than the Rockets, even with Clint Capela.
That's just based on the standings.
What's wrong with you in letting it go? Honestly, I have a problem with you letting it go.
What can I do about it?
27! Jeez!
Wait,
that's
based
so
on
bad.
The standings?
Yeah.
Why didn't you say that then? Just based completely on the standings?
Well, the standings, the point differential, Paul George.
Oh, right, but point differential. But they missed 27 threes in a row.
But you tried to take Clint Capela out of the arrangement. Like, of course not, based on the standings.
Well, I said, even if Capela is healthy, I think OKC is worse. Better. Right. I hope to be wrong
right, but
in that.
That's not based on the standings. You based it on other things than just the standings.
Agreed.
I feel like you just did 10 minutes of arguing, and it's like, well, based on the standings, Oklahoma City's better.
You're being way too rational right now.
Yeah. Am I? I'm being
too
rational?
Too level-headed. Too rational. 27 missed threes.
I know.
Seth just triggered me. God, how did that happen? They missed 27
in a row. We sat next to each other. I know.
It was I can make one. I can make one out of 25. This is physically proven.
Many of them were open.
God.
I know. I was there.
Many of them were wide open.
Listen,
how did that happen? Seriously.
The Patriots won a sixth Super Bowl. There is no God in sports. What do you want me to tell you?
Oh, so he's just dead inside. Okay, this that makes sense.
But this is... No, I don't think Mike realizes, because Mike should be the one that realizes the chances of the Patriots winning six Super Bowls was more likely than missing that many three-pointers in a row. It's just absurd. Like, the degree to which that, the impossibility of that, it's just, it's cursed is what it is, Mike.
Time now for Mad Takes. ESPN did a Outside the Lines on Bob Costas in the end of his tenure at NBC, and as part of this, Costas kind of went into detail about what went down with him and his bosses late in his NBC tenure. So December 2015, there was a Sunday night game between the Steelers and Indianapolis Colts. This was right around the time that the movie Concussion was being released. Costas said that he, you know, remember he used to do those pontificating halftime essays that people so loved, especially on Twitter. So Costas told Outside the Lines, it was a natural lead-in to make a connection between the movie and former Steelers great Mike Webster. Quote, I thought that movie would make an impact, and I thought this was a way of not only for NBC to acknowledge it, but to get out in front of it. He told Outside the Lines, in this case, he took what was an unusual step, which is he submitted the essay in advance to his bosses, the executives at NBC, but he was told he could not air it because the network was bidding for the NFL's Thursday night football package at the time. And Costas said, it was at that point I realized this was an untenable situation for me. I knew my days there were numbered. He was taken off the Super Bowl coverage. NBC chose not to comment on this Outside the Lines story, except to say in a statement that they are very disappointed after 40 years with NBC. Costas has chosen to mischaracterize and share these private interactions.
Oh, mischaracterize.
Mischaracterize.
Well, I don't think, depending on how he's characterizing them, I don't think it's outside the realm of possibilities that, okay, he was taking a vocal stance against what was going on with head injuries in the NFL and how Americans should feel about football, and that led to some kind of disconnect between him and networks that wanted to broadcast television. Like are they arguing that didn't happen? I mean, because otherwise, what are they saying? Like, no, Bob Costas just isn't a good broadcaster. Of course not.
Yeah, they definitely wouldn't argue that. I guess the implication would be that he would somehow be disparaging the league on what is now their marquee broadcast.
Yeah.
And so that, I guess, dissuades the audience and people don't want to hear it at halftime of a Sunday night football game.
Yeah, I mean, what if the reality is that they, like many people, thought that his monologues were essentially for this wine-drinking ivory tower crowd, which is not the blue-collar America that is watching the NFL every single Sunday?
Well, no, but I don't think it's even that. It's that even if you agreed with his monologues, they were just heavy-handed, and they were a buzzkill is what they are. I'm watching football. I don't need a buzzkill at halftime. That's part of the problem. This is because we live in this era now where people think that, like, oh, if you agree with me, you want to hear exactly what I believe, right? Like, no. Well, no, I agree with you, but I don't want to hear it come out of your stupid pie hole right now. And that wasn't the time and place for it, whether it was concussion issues or gun control or anything else.
Wasn't halftime a weird choice for Costas' essays anyway? In that, if you want to listen, if you want to watch an essay on TV in a sports context, usually what happened before a game, they have these forever long pregame shows. At halftime, which in the NFL is very short, it's like 10, 12 minutes, it's the big game of the week, the marquee game, Sunday Night Football. I want to hear analysis of the game, what's coming up, send it back down to Alan Chris. I don't want to sit back and be like, okay, here's Bob Costas who's going to tell me how to feel about this topic of vast import.
What an incredible first half of action we had. Have you ever seen so many one-handed catches in your life? What do you think, Bob? I'd like to talk about the oil embargo of the 1970s and its far-reaching implications in today's society, and how it's affected the way we view socio-political circumstances.
If the NFL had its way, the NFL would be with Chris Berman doing these halftime monologues. Oh, Deej! You know, like with all the Bermanisms. And I would be for that. I love Chris Berman.
I'd like to see Chris Berman do a Bob Costas op-ed, but with his own style. Like, whoop! Got some plaque on the brain there. Whoop! And then we go back to the store because you forgot what you got. You forgot what you were supposed to go in to get. That's what you get with CTE, kids. if there's any doubt as to how the NFL is affectionate about the AAF, the Alliance of American Football, For one, you're going to see it on NFL Network. Two, I go to NFL.com and the lead story. The lead story on NFL.com today. Hot shots down the Stallions in AAF action. I did not quite realize how much the NFL was supporting the AAF. I guess I had read articles, but I didn't really know if they were just kind of giving them a pat on the back. The NFL is really putting almost its full force and weight behind the AAF, which makes me wonder what's going to come of the XFL. Because the XFL doesn't want to be like the XFL from the past, but is also trying to set themselves up as a little bit of a renegade league, an option, an alternative to the NFL. I don't know what that means for him. That's going to be a plus or a minus. Because the XFL is also in some bigger cities. You look at the XFL is in, well, it's in Houston and Dallas, yep, for one. The AAF, a lot of, I would say, you know, cities like San Antonio, Memphis, oh, Atlanta's a big enough city. I don't know. Does there have to be a winner in this, or can both of those leagues eventually coexist?
I don't know if they're going to be taking place at the same time, which I think the XFL is supposed to start next year in February.
Yes,
so they're going to be on the same weekend, two leagues the same weekend. The NFL has already unofficially recognized the AAF by broadcasting their games on the NFL Network. And that is, I think, a huge step for them. And I think that if it were to turn into a battle between the two, I think that the NFL would be more likely to buy out or lend a helping hand to the league that actually seems to be doing things the way that the NFL wants. Where, hey, look, this is a feeder league for the NFL, where with the XFL is taking talent away from college. And I think that college and the NFL are linked a lot more hand in hand than we know.
Right.
Well, I just think, to answer Seth's question, yeah, I think one has to win out realistically. Because in how many situations in sports is a minor league played in the offseason? Are there multiple versions of it?
I guess, I mean, the extreme, this isn't a good comparison, I suppose, but just like at the large level, multiple soccer leagues thrive throughout the world, and some of them are major leagues, some of them are minor league. But there, you're talking about a population of the entire world, I suppose, versus football. I don't know, but I don't think looking for precedent is necessarily where you need to go with this. I guess with baseball, how many minor league teams are there? Quite a few, at least 90,
yeah.
Not to mention independent leagues. So,
but you're basically dividing, I think, by city, right? Like, I'm just thinking of it this way. Just think about the average American sports fan. It is February through April. So I've got, here's what I have going on. I've got the NBA going on. I've got college basketball and the NCAA tournament going on. I've got baseball eventually starting in that window. Am I going to watch all of that plus at two different other football leagues?
But the question is, what can survive and what can't survive?
Yes.
And it's not a matter of, is it going to be beating the NBA? Neither of these leagues plan on beating the NBA consistently.
Agreed.
I think both of them can survive. And just like I said, based on just how many different options there are, that's like almost the best argument for it. These are niche things that are going to have niche audiences, but because you can stream it, because you can capitalize off of social media, because there's so many cable outlets, I think they can both actually survive.
Okay, so we have a disagreement on this one.
This is from Mike Meltzer's homeland of Russia. An Arctic region of Russia has declared a state of emergency after 52 polar bears have regularly visited a settlement by the name of Belushia Guba, with some displaying aggressive behavior. And if you can actually go online and search on YouTube, you will see a very terrifying clip of a polar bear in what looks to be an alley about to pounce on somebody, who then closes the door and hides. This is a state of emergency. Imagine being in a town that's so remote and so cold that polar bears are just wandering in to the GD town, and they are attacking you willy-nilly. 52 polar bears. I mean, that's a lot.
That's a lot, but I don't know by comparison, like, what's a normal year for them? Do they get zero polar bears?
I think in a normal year, I think that they get multiple because they're in the Arctic region of Russia, so I'm going to guess they get like 10. But apparently now they just have started to hang out there. Like, they're now living there.
I would, Build are they wall. Not allowed to shoot them, like, for food?
No, because they're endangered. That's the worst part. They're endangered, so they can't defend themselves and kill them legally yet. But it's a state of emergency now, and I wonder if things will change on that.
They need to capitalize on this and start making a tourism thing. You'd come in and live with the polar bears. It'd be like your wild kingdom lodge at Disney World, except with polar bears who might actually eat. You know that, you ever been to the Safari Kingdom Animal Lodge Planet, whatever it is there at Disney World?
Animal Kingdom?
It's kind of, is that what it is? Well, when you stay at the lodge there, they sell you on like, oh, you wake up and you see the majesty of a giraffe outside.
I don't want that.
With the sun rising and everything. After a while, it's kind of boring. Like, oh, it's just, so these things are just like different shaped cows. Okay. Like, there's nothing exciting about these at all. They're not galloping through the savannah or anything like that.